Ok. Ça. Faites ça. My heart's desire is for Israel to be saved. That is the plea of a man who, though persecuted by Jews, both persecuted both inside the family of Christ and outside the family of Christ, still very much cared for and loved his own people. The words of Paul in Romans chapter 10. Now in Romans, we're going to focus our thoughts in Romans chapter 10 this morning. But in this letter of Romans, what Paul does is he spends a considerable amount of time and effort trying to communicate to us this idea of righteousness and what constitutes righteousness, why the people of God were unrighteous, and so on. And I guess the crux of this issue of righteousness is what is righteousness and how can we become righteous in God's eyes. And throughout this letter to the Romans, Paul shows us that there are different kinds of righteousness available. And it's possible that in the pursuit of one kind of righteousness, we can become distracted and neglect perhaps a different and more important righteousness. But coming back to basics, what do we mean by righteousness? Well, when we look it up in the old languages that the Bible was written in, in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, the idea of righteousness, it really carries the idea of something that's stiff or straight. And I think in essence, righteousness is a kind of a measure of how well you measure up to something, particularly some kind of agreement. If you made an agreement with someone to do a certain thing, they've agreed to do something, how well have you kept to that agreement? How stiff, how straight have you kept to it? How righteous have you kept, are you, to that agreement? So I think then righteousness basically is that, a measure of how faithful we have kept to an agreement that we've made. And so in some ways it's quite easy to get your head around. You can think of some Bible ideas, perhaps difficult to get your head around. You know, what exactly is, what does it mean to be just, to be fair, to be gracious? To be righteous is basically to keep to an agreement. Now when we're thinking about the righteousness of God, and what Paul is talking about a lot in this letter, we're thinking of, an agreement which is moral. You can have an immoral agreement, of course. You can imagine a situation where you have two thieves agreeing together to come together to rob a bank or whatever it might be, and one of them turns up, he's righteous, he's kept to his agreement, the other one has a change of heart, and so he's unrighteous in that concept. But of course, when we come to God, his righteousness is a moral righteousness, isn't it? Because, God would never make any kind of agreement which wasn't that. What is the agreement then that Paul is talking about in this letter? Well, he talks a little bit about the righteousness of the law. That's the agreement that Moses and the people of Israel made, and what the nation of Israel were born into. The covenant made at Sinai. He talks a little bit about that, but he particularly focuses on the righteousness which comes from faith. And when we think, what agreement is that built on? Well, I think that takes us really all the way back to the beginning, to the Garden of Eden. And when we go back to the Garden of Eden, and remember the story there of Adam and Eve, the agreement that God and made with Adam and Eve, it wasn't about whether or not he should eat a piece of particular piece of fruit or not. Obviously, that was part of it, but it was really about being in God's image. That's the language, isn't it, of the first chapters of Genesis, about being in God's image, and for them then to go out and fill the world with the glory and knowledge of God, and in turn, God, he would be with man, he would dwell with man, he would give him dominion over the earth. And Paul, he reminds us that it's our faith, because of our faith, the faith that we have in Christ, that God views us as if we are still in his image, as if we have kept to the agreement. He overlooked everything that would offend, that would make us fall short, because of our faith, because of Christ. Because Christ, after all, you know, he's described, isn't he, in Hebrews as being in the express image of the Father. He was the perfect image. Jesus became the Emmanuel, didn't he? God with us. And because we have put on Christ, when God looks at us, he sees not us as we really are, but he sees us as Christ, as a perfect image of himself. So, but this putting on of Christ, lest we think that this is some kind of, you know, passive thing, it's a one-time thing, we're baptised and then that's it. It's not just about a confession of faith and a baptism, because faith, a true faith, is one that is active, it's one that is powerful, it's one that is picking up on an idea we talked about earlier this morning. It's transformative. I will show you my faith by the things that I do, says James. Not so much that by doing certain things leads to faith, but that faith leads to us doing these things. It has that powerful impact on us. It transforms our character. It moulds us slowly, bit by bit, into the image of the Father. So that when God looks at us, he sees us actually as a little bit of a reflection of himself. So that putting on of Christ then, it's not the end. You know, it's just the start of a process. It sees that small reflection being filled out a little bit, at least, into something a little bit more. And this is really a large part of, I think, what Paul talks about in Romans, in the early chapters. Then we come to chapter 10. One way I think of looking at chapter 10 is to think of this now, Paul dealing with an objection. So we get to this stage in Romans, we're led to believe that this faith, it's this powerful thing, it's this transformative thing, this righteousness, you know, it's available for us, the righteousness which comes from faith. And we come to chapter 10, and you can imagine somebody saying, well, that's all very well and good, Paul. You know, belief in God, righteousness, putting your trust, putting on Christ, all of that. That sounds great, it sounds fantastic. But if faith is so powerful and transformative, why have the people of Israel, God's own people, the people who most should have been influenced by God, by faith, why have they failed so badly? That's the challenge that Paul finds when he gets to chapter 10. And he feels compelled to deal with this objection. And the way that he deals with the objection, I think, is quite interesting. Because what he does, effectively, he deals with the entire process of transformation. And just kind of mapping out a little bit what this process of transformation is. In some ways, it's quite simple. Not an easy thing to do, but in some ways, it's quite simple. Because you start with an idea, a body of knowledge. So for the Jews, it could have been the law. You know, for us, it's the gospel, isn't it? It's the knowledge of the love of Christ. That kind of is the starting point. Then it needs to be transferred somehow, communicated somehow to an audience. So there's no point having this knowledge, whatever it is, on its own. It needs to be communicated. Once communicated, the audience needs to hear, needs to listen to that message, needs to see it, needs to take it in. No good just doing that. It then needs to kind of get into the person. There needs to be, you know, going away, thinking about it, meditating it, allowing it to kind of become part of us, letting it impact on our thinking, and so on. And then the final stage, once this message has been communicated, once we've heard it, once it's got into us, once it's affected us, it then kind of comes out of us, doesn't it? It goes out into our hands, into our feet, into our voices. And see some of these ideas coming out in Romans chapter 10. What I'm going to do is just kind of quickly go through the first few verses and just pull out some of these ideas. And what I did when I was doing this, I drew up a little bit of a table, and I had the stages on one side and the verse numbers on the other, and, you know, kind of a tick box, if you like, as you was going down. So just kind of just drawing out some of the ideas then. If you start in chapter 1, in verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, "Brothers, my heart's desire." So he's immediately talking about the internal side of things. "My heart's desire and prayer," communication there, prayer, "is that they may be saved. I bear them witness," so it's a communicated, it's a message communicated, "that they have a zeal for God," so they have an external something, a zeal, "but not according to knowledge," so the initial source, the initial knowledge is wrong. "For being ignorant," knowledge, "of the righteousness that comes from God, seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law," the end of the one bit of knowledge, "for righteousness to everyone who believes," has been impacted internally. "For Moses writes," he communicates, "about the righteousness which is based on law," an initial knowledge, "that the person who does something external of commandments shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart," something internal, and then he quotes from Deuteronomy. Then in verse 8, "but what does it say?" Communication again. "The word," message, whatever, "is near you, it's in your mouth, it's in your heart, it's internal, it's external. That is the faith that we proclaim," communication again. "Because if you confess external with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, believe in your heart internal that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes internal and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses external and is saved." That just gives a flavour of these different parts of the process which Paul highlights as he's going through, and it kind of it continues on. So if we perhaps go with this idea that what Paul is doing some kind of examination of this process of transformation, and that's transformation into the image of God, becoming righteous, perhaps then kind of understand a little bit more about why Paul picks the verses, the passages from the Old Testament that he does. Because in this chapter he quotes quite a lot from the Old Testament, and we might think, why does he pick these particular verses? If we think transformation, we can perhaps understand a little bit why he picks these verses in particular. I'll pick verse 8. I'll go with verse 8. What does it say? "The word is near you, in your mouth, in your heart." Now he's quoting there from Deuteronomy, chapter 30. So just keep a finger there and come into Deuteronomy, chapter 30. This is Moses speaking to the people of Israel just before they're going to go into the land. Chapter 30, verse 6, he's kind of just giving a bit of a context. "And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart." He's going to transform you on the inside, basically, is what that's saying, "and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, that you may live." And then a little bit down, verse 10. The end of verse 10, he says, "You will turn to the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul." So there has to be some kind of transformation there. And how does that happen? Start of verse 10. "When you obey the voice of the Lord your God, when you keep his commandments and his statutes that are written in the book of the law." So you've got the message of God, it comes into you, listen to it, and it has this impact on you. So what he's talking about. And then verse 12 is where Paul quotes from. "It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us to bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it?" And he carries on, he quotes verse 13 and 14 as well. Then if we read verse 15, "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, then I command you today," external. So he wants you to externally put stuff into practice. It's interesting, he says, how do you do that? How do you put these things into practice? "You obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, how? By loving the Lord your God and by walking in his ways and by keeping his commandments." The first thing he says, to do the external, you have to love the Lord your God. So there's got to be that internal transformation first. Otherwise, the external, it's just going to be like a transient thing. It's not going to be powerful. It's not going to be deep within you. The internal there has to come first. Come back into Romans chapter 10. Verse 11. The scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. You know, that is a quote from Isaiah. So again, keep your finger there and come into Isaiah. This time it's Isaiah chapter 28. So he's quoting from around about 16, I think it is. But again, just kind of giving them a little bit of context. The time that Isaiah writes this chapter, Israel is in a little bit, well, Judah it is. Judah's in a little bit of a mess. You've got a bad king on the throne, Ahaz, and, you know, his bad influences kind of flow down into the priest, into the prophets. Nobody's really doing, you know, what they should be doing. Verse 7. It says, these also reel with wine and stagger with strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They are swallowed by wine. They stagger with strong drink. They reel in vision. They stumble in giving judgment. All the tables are full of filthy vomit with no space left. To whom will he teach knowledge? So these are the people who should be communicating the message to the people. You know, how can the people be impacted by God's word if it's not even being communicated to them? The priest and the prophet, they're stumbling around, aren't they? They're not doing what they should be doing. So he says in verse 9, to whom will we teach knowledge? To whom will we explain the message? Those who are weaned from the milk, those taken from the breasts. For it is precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. It's got to get in there slowly and have a chance to have an impact, but it's not happening. And then he says a little bit later, verse 15, you know, because you have said, you know, we have made a covenant with death. It's not a covenant with God. It's not an agreement with God. It's a covenant with death that they've kept. That's the agreement that they've made. With Sheol, we have made an agreement. At the end of that verse, we have made lies our refuge. You know, so you can think, can't you? It's the false truth, the lies. That's the thing which they're hearing. That's the thing that when they get inside them. That's the thing that's having an impact on them. In falsehood we have taken shelter. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am the one who has laid as a foundation in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. And then this is where he quotes from, whoever believes will not be in haste. So despite the fact that this falseness is there and it's impacting and influencing people, he's going to make sure that there's this foundation there that people can put their trust on. And obviously for us, in the New Testament, this is picked up on. This foundation is Christ, isn't it? You know, we base ourselves on Christ, and the transformation is in the right way, isn't it? Then flip back to Romans chapter 10. Coming to verse 15 now. Paul writes there, how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. And this time it's Isaiah again, chapter 52. So again, keep a finger there and come back to Isaiah chapter 52. Verse 6, we'll start with. Quotes a little bit later, but it's verse 7 he's quoting from. But verse 6, therefore my people shall know my name. So that's the knowledge of God, who he is, the knowledge of his name. That's what is being communicated, that's what's having the influence. Therefore in that day they shall know that it is I who speak, here am I. How beautiful, this is where Paul quotes from, upon the mountains, are the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. And the message it's getting through, the voice of your watchmen, they lift up their voice, together they sing for joy, for eye to eye they see the return of the Lord to Zion. Break forth into singing, you waste places. of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. So, you know, this message has got through, and you can see the impact it has on them, breaking into singing there. So again, come back to Romans. Verse 16. So Isaiah again, this time it's the next chapter of Isaiah, chapter 53. He quotes, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? And you might recognise that. Who has believed our report? That's from Isaiah chapter 53. So again, keep your finger there and come back to Isaiah chapter 53. It's verse 1 that he's quoting from. So you're kind of contrasting it with verse 52, this positive message getting through, having an effect on people. And then here, you know, who actually has heard this message comes the challenge. Who has believed our report? To whom is the arm of the Lord being revealed? And then there's the famous passage about Christ there in chapter 53. You know it well. But you kind of come down towards the end. Verse 11. Because all of the suffering servant, you know, the death that he endures. Then verse 11, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. So by his knowledge he shall have a transformative effect on people. Starts in our lives, completed, isn't it, in the resurrection. Many will be accounted righteous, viewed as righteous by God. I'll come back to Romans chapter 10. Just one more I want to look at. Verse 18 of Romans chapter 10. But I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. And this is a quote from the Psalms, Psalm 19. So again, we're going to finish in Romans, but come back to Psalm 19. You know, it starts in verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. You know, the knowledge of God is being communicated, you know, in every way. You know, even, you know, in creation, it's being communicated. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. The sky above declares his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, no other words, whose voice is not heard. I think that's where he was quoting from, wasn't it? Yeah, that's where he was quoting from. Verse 2. But if you're kind of interested to kind of carry on, verse 3 was quoting from. Yeah, there is no speech, no other word whose voice is not heard. So the message is getting through. But when you carry on reading, a little bit further on in this chapter, verse 7, talking about this message which is getting through and its transformative effect. The law of the Lord is perfect, it revives the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, it makes wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. And so on. The transformative power of the knowledge of God. So come back to Romans chapter 10. How does all this help Paul answer the challenge then of, you know, why, in the case of the Jews at least, faith seems to have been ineffective? I think what he does is he illustrates that the Jews, and obviously us too, we can fall into difficulties at every stage of this process. So it could be we take an interest in the wrong kind of knowledge to start with. We listen to the wrong message. It could be that it's a good message, but it's not been communicated well. Might be that we don't listen to it properly. It could be that we hear it, but then dismiss it. Don't really take it on board. Don't really dwell on it. Don't take it into our hearts. Or it could be that once we have thought about it and let it impact us, we then don't do anything with it. We don't act. We don't let that transformation come out of us. Which part then of this process is the weak link? Well, Paul looks at the process then. from verse 14. He says, how are they to call an external thing on in whom they have not believed? So before the external, it says you need the internal. But how are they to believe in him of whom they have not heard? How are they to hear without someone preaching, without someone communicating it? And they're all the way back to the beginning. How are they to preach unless they are sent, as it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But then it carries on, verse 18. I ask, have they not heard? And he says, indeed they have. So the message is there and it has been communicated. That's that verse from the Psalms that we looked at. And then he says in verse 19, I ask, did Israel not understand? Well, they did understand. So the problem then, I guess, is it drops down there, doesn't it, in the heart. So that the message is communicated, it is there. We do see it, we cannot not see it, even if it's looking at the creation. The message does get through. But it's quite often the heart, and certainly in the case of Israel, they had the law there as well. We have the gospel, we have the knowledge of Christ. Do we let it impact on us? That's, if you like, I think, where the weak link is, isn't it? It's the heart. That's the weak link. It's easy for other messages, other thoughts, other philosophies, other distractions to get in the way. So I think the danger to us is clear then. If we don't take the time to think, if we don't take the time to meditate, to chew things over, to keep that message, you know, the love of Christ, make that meaningful, real to us, then it's easy for it to become crowded out and dulled by other things. That transformative power is dulled, isn't it? So, you know, the warning, I suppose, for us, the exhortation for us, is to learn from the Jews, the failure of many of them, who, though hearing, heard not, and who, though seeing, saw not. And let us instead remember and meditate on and believe the report. Let that knowledge of Christ and the knowledge of the name of the Lord transform us, and let us call on that name. For as it says elsewhere, you know, he who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved.